Orchids. They're quite remarkable, aren't they? At the bottom, you have pretty ordinary leaves that don't look like anything special, and some rather crazy roots that go all over the place. But at the top, you have the most incredible flowers. Incredibly delicate, yet really, really very striking. And orchids come in all numbers of different colours. It's thought that there are around 30,000 species, but nobody really knows. And they're the widest and largest family of plants in the world. They are really quite remarkable flowers, and they grow sort of on vines, mainly in South America. And anybody who has ever done any kind of baking, whether you made a Victoria sponge or anything like that, will probably take these for granted. Because thousands of years ago, somewhere in South America, somebody discovered that on a particular type of orchid, the way the seeds grow, they grow into a little container. And somebody discovered if you, quite by accident, if you take it off the plant and then put in some water and then dry it for about 6 months, you end up with a little black pod. And it's an incredibly fragrant, delicious pod. And it's a vanilla pod. There you go, that grows on vines in South America. Now, in the wild, it's incredibly rare to actually find seeds growing as a vanilla pod on an orchid. Firstly, there's 30,000 species of orchids, and there's only one vanilla orchid. But it's incredibly rare because they open up for pollination. Don't really know the technical terms, but for pollination, for only 12 hours a day for one time in the year. And they're normally pollinated by a specific type of bee, which makes them even harder to come by, or a hummingbird. So kind of a beautiful combination of things, I think. But one day, a chap called Edmund, a 12-year-old boy, discovered that actually you could pollinate the flower, stem, stamen thing by hand. And suddenly, in I think it was 1871, an enormous industry started. Just the ingenuity of one 12-year-old boy who discovered you could do it by hand meant that everybody now gets to taste vanilla, or vanilla extract, or whatever type of vanilla you use. So the next time you do some baking, don't take it for granted. It's incredibly, I think, beautiful that God has given us such an amazing flower, and yet gives us something like a vanilla pod as well. So this evening we are considering how to enjoy food and drink. There's not a particular passage that we're looking at. We're going to see kind of a number of verses across the Bible to kind of gain the bigger picture. We're also not going to be considering the dangers of food and drink, though there are of course some. We're also not going to be looking at, say, how we can have enjoyment from food and drink, whether we make it and share it with other people, as much fun as that is. We're also not going to be considering how much fun there is to be found in growing food. You could try growing a vanilla pod, or producing it, or catching it, or whatever, as much as I like fishing as well. Or not fishing, as it tends to be. But we're going to look at a particular attitude towards food and drink that I think is the key to unlocking true enjoyment in food and drink. And it's kind of what Tom was getting at this morning. So hopefully, if you're here this morning, you get kind of a nice complimentary sort of morning and evening slot. Now, it doesn't take you very long, though, to see that when you start reading the Bible, there does appear to be a kind of tension between enjoying the things of earth and God himself. Enjoying the Creator and enjoying the created, there does appear to be this kind of tension. For example, you probably read verses like Philippians chapter 3, 18 to 20, where Paul is describing a group of people who are destined for destruction, and he gives us the reason why. In quite graphic language, he says, "For their God is their belly, it's their stomach. Their minds are set on earthly things." Or perhaps you've read more of Paul writing Colossians. He tends to say things like this, where he writes to Christians there saying, "Since then you've been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God the Father. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. So, that's that series out the window then, isn't it? But is that the case? Well, firstly, those who are eagle-eyed will have realised I perhaps pushed those verses just ever so slightly out of their proper context. Paul never meant things like food and drink when he was saying those kind of things. In fact, he was saying things like sinful attitudes towards those kind of things. But if you were to turn to, say, 1 Timothy 4, where we were this morning, and I'd encourage you to turn there, that's the kind of base text that we might come back to. We'd read this in 1 Timothy 4, verse 4, "Everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving." And later on in 1 Timothy, if you turn over the page to chapter 6, verse 17, you find this verse. "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth," so make sure they don't have this sinful attitude, which is uncertain, "but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything we need." Well, have I read that right? Would somebody read the last three words of chapter 6, verse 17 for us? Yeah, for our enjoyment. It's very easy to read that verse and go, "for our need." But actually, it doesn't say that. It says, "for our enjoyment." God has created things for us to enjoy. Or elsewhere, we read this verse in Genesis, in chapter 2, verse 9. It says, "The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye," orchid, "and good for food," orchid. So on one hand, it seems to be that you have the Bible telling you earthly things are bad and only love God. But then on the other hand, we also sort of have, well, love God and earthly things aren't too bad. So it's a funny kind of tension that we often find ourselves in. And I have been cheeky in pushing some of those verses to places where they perhaps shouldn't go. But I suspect from experience you know what I mean. Because I wonder if we've told ourselves that that is what the Bible says. Because we've experienced the same kind of thing in day-to-day life. And perhaps we go to one extreme on this kind of imaginary line. So perhaps we go to this extreme over here. That's where our response to food and drink goes like this, or perhaps any created thing. And it basically says food and drink is bad. Food and drink is actually even evil. It's incredibly bad, and we should absolutely avoid it. It's kind of what Tom was hinting at this morning. It's what the technical term, for those kind of you, is the Gnosticism. That's what it's getting at. It's saying fleshly things are just bad, they're to be avoided. And we can probably, if we've been there at some point or another, justify it with a nice little neat evangelical Christian phrase, which is, "all I need is Jesus." So in that camp over here, all I need is Jesus. I have Jesus. What could I want of earthly things? And I say that from experience because I was definitely in this camp over here. And I was in this camp when I became a Christian. Because welcoming Christ into my life, giving my life to Christ, was the dominating thought in my mind and in my heart. So I thought to myself, well, why would I let earthly things get in the way? And so as a 16, 17-year-old, I was quite tempted by a monastery, if I'm honest. But then I read Luther, and he's quite derogatory about monasteries. But then perhaps we move over here, and this is where we say, well, okay, food isn't bad, sort of created by God, but we shouldn't necessarily enjoy it. It's there for our need, not for our enjoyment. And then we move perhaps slightly over here. We say, well, food is good, actually. I quite enjoy food, and I quite love God. But there appears to be a sort of tangible tension. Because as much as I enjoy food, I also think, well, shouldn't I really enjoy God more? And vice versa. And also, you begin to think, well, there's a voice in the back of your head saying, is it right that I really enjoy food? And we can begin to apply that quite easy when we begin to think of things like money as well. And I suspect that's where most of us sit, in that thing where we do love God and we do love food, but there's a sense of tension between the two. And then we sort of move over here. And this is where, actually, we love food, but we're not very responsible about it. Perhaps it's taken over our lives. Perhaps it's become something that we obsess about. And it's not necessarily a case that we eat too much food. It might be that we have a different type of obsession about food. So it might not be a gluttony of excess, but it might be, as C.S. Lewis puts it, a gluttony of delicacy. That actually we have to have a proper cup of tea and a proper meal. And that's not a bad thing for any reason whatsoever. In fact, we should, as Christians, say, actually, we do want a really, really good cup of tea and really nice food, because that's what we should do. But it's a problem when we are obsessive about it. And the easiest way to measure that is, what's the impact it's having on those around you, not necessarily you? Are you just too picky about your food for no good reason? So in that camp, food's become an idol. And then there's a random camp which doesn't really go anywhere on the line. And it's the camp that says, do you know, I love God and I love food, but the two aren't integrated. There's no link between my love for God and my love for food. And if I'm honest, that's for most of the time where I find myself. In fact, I love food. I really do love food, and I hope I really love God equally. But the two often don't really go together. So I wonder where on that line you may be. I know I've kind of wandered from this end to this end quite radically over the years. And so what we've done, I think, is probably told ourselves what we think the Bible tells us about food. So we recognise this kind of quite tangible tension. And it basically ends up with this. It's either one or the other. So we've pitted loving and enjoying food and loving and enjoying God against each other. And so when we try to bring the two things together, we just go, oh, they don't really fit. In day-to-day life, there seems to be this awkward tension. And so this evening, what we're going to do is follow on from what Tom said this morning and see, actually, how can we integrate these two things together? Without going to one of the extremes, how can these two things come together in harmony? And we're going to do that because I think actually in resolving the tension between the two is also where we find most enjoyment, proper, right enjoyment. And so we're going to see that once we've got that tension solved, and we'll be on the path to solving that tension, that actually when we come to enjoy food and drink, we'll also be coming to enjoy God more and more with every bite and sip and mouthful. We'll see that actually in resolving this tension, that food is glorious food. That food is indeed food, glorious food, whether it's a hot sausage and mustard or a plate of cold jelly and custard. So as we come to deal with this tension, there's firstly something we have to recognise. Firstly, this is it. It was never supposed to be like this. Cast your minds back to the Garden of Eden. That's quite a long way back, but cast your minds back. They have Adam and Eve in perfect harmony with God. And we see something quite profound, which also perhaps may come out next week when we come to look at relationships as well. Because God and man are in perfect harmony between the two of them. But you notice something, because there, if when I was back here, when I was 15, 16, just become a new Christian, I'd look at that and go, oh, yes. Perfect. God and man in perfect harmony. That's the way it was always supposed to be, without silly distractions like food and drink to get in the way. But what had God done? Well, he'd already made food and drink. And there's something quite profound there. It's quite simple, but quite profound. Because God had no need to create food for humans' need. It wasn't that God had a rule book which he had to follow. He had no need to create food for humans' need. But he chose to make food for humans' delight and enjoyment. C.S. Lewis puts it vaguely like this: God likes food because he invented it. I think that's a great little kind of quip to fight back at yourself when you are feeling that kind of low-level sense of guilt for no good reason. God likes food, he invented it. There's no point trying to be more spiritual than God himself. So where there once was no tension, well, what happened next? Well, we know where the story went. Humankind jumped, we fell, and suddenly this tension is now there. So what are we to do? We're now fallen people in a fallen world, experience this kind of tension. So how do we solve a problem like this tension? How do we properly enjoy God as well as his gifts? Well, you've probably already said it today, and in fact, Tom encouraged us to say it this morning. It's all about saying grace. Turn with me to Romans chapter 1, if you would. In Romans chapter 1, verse 18, Paul tells us what's wrong with us as people, what's wrong with mankind. He says that God's wrath, that's his perfect, just, slow, steady anger, is being revealed, because even though we know that God is there, whether we like to say that or not, we've decided that we would not give glory to God nor thank him. And that's the problem. We've decided not to thank God. We're quite happy to take his gifts and enjoy his gifts, but not really say thank you. We're quite happy to take his gifts, but not necessarily take him. And that's why we have this tension, because the gifts take the place of the giver. And so at the extreme, food becomes an idol, like these people in this camp over here. Food becomes an idol that we obsess about. In the middle ground, we experience this kind of tension, because we sort of want to enjoy food, but we're also sort of wanting to enjoy God properly. And then over here, at the other extreme, by completely rejecting food, we are in fact despising God himself. If somebody gave you a present and you wholly rejected it, doesn't make them feel particularly nice, does it? And so it's our lack of gratitude that's the problem, wherever we are on that spectrum. So in seeing the problem in Romans 1, we then find the cure, as we did this morning, back in 1 Timothy 4. Everything God creates is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. So what I want to consider is, why then does thanksgiving actually really solve this tension? And why is it that in saying thank you to God, do we actually find properly good enjoyment of these things? Why will your morning cup of coffee taste better if you say grace? Why would your Victoria sponge taste better if you said grace? And I think the key to solving the tension is this, that by saying thank you to God, we are realizing our utter dependency upon him for all that we have. And then by saying thank you, we're also then free to enjoy the gift, as it should be. So perhaps this is a way to explain it. The word dependent originally comes from the Latin word, and completely forgive my Latin pronunciation, pendere. Don't know, is that how you say it? I don't really know. But the Latin word pendere gives us the word dependent. And the Latin word meant to hang, literally like a pendant hangs around your neck, hence pendant. And the writer G.K. Chesterton used this idea to illustrate something quite well. In life, we take many things for granted, particularly the things we love most. For example, this building is one of my favourite buildings in the whole of Norwich. Rich architectural design, it's extraordinary. Now, I do like it, partly because of the staircase. I think the little coloured specks in the stones are fantastic. But mainly, it's the people who are here. That's why I love this building. It's you. That's why I love this building, because when I come here, I see you, and that's a nice thing. But because it's one of those things I often take for granted, there are certain things about it that I take for granted. So, we probably take, for example, we take it for granted that actually this building is built into, we hope, solid foundations laid into the earth. That's what I think CMT hope. But imagine if Surrey Chapel was to be hoisted up by a crane and hung upside down. Might look something like this. You can tell I teach graphic design, don't you? Suddenly, the exact same building, made of the same stuff, looks helpless and in peril. It once looked very, very secure, laid into the ground, very solid and safe. But now, it's kind of looking quite dodgy. It's not even the picture. Now, it's the same building, made of the same stuff, but suddenly our attitude towards it will change. I suspect the kind of love that we have for it would grow in this moment, and the type of love that we have for it would grow as well. Because instead of simply taking it for granted, suddenly we see that it is indeed in peril, that the only thing holding it up is the crane and the rope or the chain. And suddenly we've realised the fragility of the building's position, because if something were to happen, if something were to happen to the crane, the building drops. And it's probably the same kind of attitude and the change in our love when we see perhaps a loved one who is in danger. Suddenly our experience in that moment will change the kind of love that we have for them. Our love will suddenly, I suspect, grow quite quickly, quite rapidly, if we were to see somebody that we love in danger. And so it's the same with the building. But it's also the same with food and drink. So the building is completely dependent on the rope and chain holding it up. And our attitude towards the rope and chain is probably one of thankfulness, because it's the only thing stopping it from falling down. So our attitude towards the rope and chain is thankfulness. And it can be the same with food and drink. When we realise that we are utterly dependent upon God for everything we have, and that is everything we have, then our appreciation of the food and drink will grow, and our appreciation of God himself would grow. Because we realise it's not ours by right. It's ours by a free gift from a loving Father. So the best way to grow our appreciation of food and drink is to realise, actually, we're wholly dependent on God for it, whether we really like to think that or not. And the best way to really grow that in practice, I think, in terms of food and drink, is to start from zero. There's a common phrase which is, blessed is he that expects nothing, for he won't be disappointed. But St. Francis of Assisi put it slightly differently. He turned that phrase upside down. He said, blessed is he who expects nothing, for he shall enjoy everything. What that means in layman's terms is, count your blessings and start from zero. So that, remember, when you wake up in the morning, the only reason why you woke up is that God kept you breathing through the night. So suddenly you're slightly more thankful to him. Remember that when you walk out of your bedroom into the kitchen, the only reason you're walking into the kitchen is that by God's grace you have a kitchen to walk into. And with that kind of attitude, you'll probably thank God. And then remember, when you go to make that cup of coffee, the only reason it's there is that God has given us as mankind the capability to turn a little red coffee cherry into a dark roasted coffee bean. And so if we begin to thank God, if we begin to have that attitude continually towards food and drink, we'll be more thankful, And then we'll begin to see that actually, by being more thankful to him, by realizing our dependency upon him, the stuff that he gives us will probably taste better. For example, your morning coffee, I think, will taste better. And that's where the really kind of short second point is. Think back to the vanilla pod. Think about the journey that it takes for this vanilla pod to get from orchid, not this orchid, but an orchid to this, to be able to place in your kitchen cupboard to forget about for 3 years and then take it out to make a custard. It's the same principle that a lot of restaurants are based on. A lot of restaurants always use locally grown produce, and the only reason they really do that is because we like to know where our food comes from. And actually, the restaurant's idea is it probably makes the food taste better, or at least it might make us feel as though it tastes better. And it's the same thing when you see perhaps a work of art. The question that you begin to ask is, well, look at that amazing piece of work. That's an extraordinary piece of art. You begin to ask questions like, well, where has it come from? Who has made it? If you walked past a patisserie shop in Paris, you'd see amazing cakes in the shop window, and you begin to think, well, look how beautifully and intricately crafted that cake is. The person who made it must be incredibly skillful. How talented must that person be? And so by thanking God for food and drink that he's given to us, we're remembering where the food and drink comes from. And it's come from our loving Father. And why does that food taste nice? Why is it that when you bite into a juicy peach, the kind of juice runs and dribbles down your chin and then dribbles onto your shirt? Why does peach juice just overflow like that? Why, as Psalm 104 says, does wine gladden the heart of man? Why, as Proverbs 24 says, that honey is sweet? Why does chocolate give you such a nice emotional boost? Why do chips and ketchup and mayonnaise taste so good? Why does a thing of candy floss or a stick of rock suddenly bring back so powerfully childhood memories? Why does a freshly picked strawberry taste so beautifully divine? We've already seen the answer. Look back to Romans chapter 1, verse 20 with me. Paul says that since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen in the things that have been made. And we see that same principle applied in all of the creation psalms. Psalm 104 that I just quoted about wine gladdening the heart of man, the psalmist looks at creation and says, isn't God great? So since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities have been clearly seen in the things that have been made. So food is God's own illustration for himself. Food is God's own analogy. Food is God's metaphor. So when we eat a freshly picked strawberry, we get a taste of what the good Father is like. And when you taste it and enjoy it, you'll probably respond in gratitude. And so when we eat a freshly picked strawberry, we can wonder to ourselves and begin to think, well, this tastes so delicious and sweet. What must he be like? Our thanks for the strawberry then goes on a journey. We thank God for it. We heartily enjoy it. And then that will lead to our adoration of him. So we go from thanks to enjoyment to adoration. The Spanish word meaning to taste is sabor. And the Spanish word meaning to know is saber. The two words on paper are remarkably similar. And I think you can begin to see something here. Because to taste and enjoy the drink and food of this world is to begin to taste and know God himself. To taste and enjoy the sweetness of a strawberry is to know the sweetness of God. This world is the starter for the feast that shall come in heaven. So when you're looking for the key to resolve that tension between the kind of enjoyment of God and enjoyment of food and created things, just say grace. Very simply, say thank you. Because immediately that begins to change our attitude towards those created things. And start from zero. Start from nothing. Thank God for that first cup of coffee for the day. And then for that cereal or whatever you might eat for breakfast. If we start with that kind of attitude, I suspect we'll begin to really savour and enjoy the things that we're eating. To finish, G.K. Chesterton, who I mentioned earlier, said this about saying grace. You say grace before meals, all right? But I say grace before the concert and the opera, and grace before the play and the pantomime, and grace before I open a book, and grace before sketching or painting or swimming or fencing or walking or playing or dancing. And grace before I dip the pen in the ink. So as we come back to the orchid, let's not take the orchid for granted. It gives us vanilla beans. But let's not take food for granted either. Because if we truly thank God, we'll be on the right path, in the right direction towards knowing him better.